Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in 75 countries around the world. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on oxymorons when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton. Now, John Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Well, Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there is no such thing at this date of world's history in 1880 in America as an independent press. Now, you know it and I know it. And there is not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand it would never appear in print. And I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinion out of the paper that I am connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. Now, the business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now, you know it, and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings, and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes, unquote. Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and the New World Order. They're the men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package first? It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. To order that free CD package, again, that number is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we've been talking about oxymorons. They're kind of fun, and they're kind of funny. The term military intelligence oftentimes gets a little smile or a chuckle, you know, when you think about it. Remember the definition from Webster's. An oxymoron comes from two words, O-X-Y-S, oxys, and it means sharp, plus moros, M-O-R-O-S, which means foolish. It's a combination for epigrammic effect of contradictory or incongruous words, such as cruel kindness, military intelligence. So an oxymoron, then, is the opposite to common sense. It's the opposite to reason, logic, common sense. It's, in short, insane. And insanity is where we expect to do the same thing over and over again and get a different result each time. Oxymoron. Are you a practicing communist? I did a series of lectures in Salt Lake City, Utah, many years ago. And I had an audience of about 200 people, and I asked that question. And I had been invited there by the local Ford dealer, whose business was down on South State Street. And we were meeting in a hall on South State Street, or in a meeting place. I think it was a Holiday Inn or a Ramada or something like that. Maybe it was the American Inn. My host, the guy that had put this meeting together and invited all the people there, the local Ford dealer, a local Mormon fellow, he was sitting in the front row. And he was there with his wife, and he must have had about 5, 6, 8 kids, I don't know. They lined up and they took the whole front center section right up in the front of the meeting room. And I asked that question, are you a practicing communist? And I looked around the room, and I said, how many of you out there are practicing communists? Let me see your hands, you know. So I raised my hand, and I looked all over, you know, and 4 or 5 people in the audience, you know, raised their hands. And, of course, my host, the Ford dealer, he didn't raise his hand. And he certainly wasn't a practicing communist. And so I said, well, thank you very much. I'm really impressed with you people here in the land of Mormons, that there are so few practicing communists, because all over America there are practicing communists, fifth columnists, who are in our midst claiming that they are anti-communists, but in reality they actually can be known by their fruits. So I said, for instance, the first plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for the abolition of property and land and the application of all rent of land to public purposes. And I said, here in America, we practice this as an example. Here in the West, the federal government claims to own much of this land out here in the West. And if you want to use this land, you have to go to the BLM or to the Department of Agriculture or to the Forest Service or somebody, and sign a contract with them and pay them rent to put your cattle out there or to mine on that land. Now, there was a time when we had private property in this country in which you owned the property. But today, we have to pay a property tax on that property. We don't have a low-deal tenure and title. And if you don't pay your property tax on your home, your business, or your farm, or your land, then it will be taken from you and sold on the courthouse steps to somebody else who will pay that tax, who will pay that rent. So if you take a look at all of the land in America, and then you compare it to the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of property and land, you don't own any land. You are renting it from the state, and you pay a tax. You pay a rent on it. And if you don't pay the rent, then you're going to lose that property. And I turned to the audience, and I said, how many of you pay a property tax? And about half the people in the audience raised their hands. Again, the Ford dealer didn't raise his hand. I went on to the second plank, and I said, the second plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. I said, there are many Americans who pay this heavy progressive or graduated income tax here in America. And I pointed out to my audience that there was a time in America when we didn't pay this heavy progressive income tax, that Americans were free from this tax. Again, I ask the audience, how many of you here in the audience pay a heavy progressive income tax? Nearly everybody in the audience raised their hands, except the Ford dealer sitting in the front row. The third plank, I said to my audience, I said, calls for the abolition of all right of inheritance. And I said, here in America, the inheritance tax just represents approximately 1/3 of the estate. And I said, most of us go out and get a marriage license, and we create a three-party limited general partnership between the boy, the girl, and the state. Time goes on, and the boy and girl working together, they accumulate some wealth. Usually houses and cars and snow machines and farms and cattle and things like that. And then one day old Bill dies. And Martha says, oh good, Bill died. Now I get all of the toys. And then I pointed out, until we come to the inheritance tax, in which the state, the third party in the game, comes forward and says, wait, Martha. We have a marriage agreement here, and we have an inheritance tax. And the inheritance tax is just one third. It runs 28-35% across the country. And we want you, Martha, to buy me out. So I suggested to the audience, how many of you here have a marriage license with your spouse in a three-party limited general partnership, and do you have an inheritance tax here in Utah? And again, nearly everybody in the audience raised their hands. Yes, they did in fact have a marriage license, and yes, we do indeed have an inheritance tax here in Utah. I noticed that my host, the Ford dealer, did not raise his hand. The fourth plank, I pointed out, calls for the confiscation of the property of all immigrants and rebels. And I pointed out that there is a process going on called regional government with absolute federal control over all property, public and private. And that this confiscation of the property of all immigrants and rebels was a part and parcel with the IRS program of seizing and distraining people's property and selling it if they don't pay their income tax or social security taxes and so on. And I said, do you have any kinds of, or more than one, or any government agents or agencies who might seize your property, confiscate your property through distraint if you didn't pay these taxes? And everybody in the audience raised their hands and said, we have an IRS. We have a state tax commission. Yeah, we have OSHA and the EPA. We have a whole host and plethora of government agencies that have the power to take our businesses, our homes, our property, seize our bank accounts. Yes, nearly everybody raised their hands. Everybody except the Ford dealer, my host, sitting in the front row. I went on to the fifth commandment. Oh, excuse me. I meant the fifth plank. I keep forgetting. You know, we Americans used to practice the Ten Commandments here in the United States. Now, the Ten Commandments are the exact opposite to the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. You see, the Ten Commandments have a commandment that says, thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not steal is the basis. It is the foundation of property rights. If you want to own property, you have to have a law that says thou shalt not steal. I've often wondered if that's why we took the Ten Commandments out of our public schools. Well, anyway, I went on to the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto, and I pointed out, it calls for the centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. So I looked up and I turned to the audience and I said, now, do you have a Federal Reserve Bank here in Salt Lake City? Do you have any Federal Reserve notes circulating in your stores and businesses? Do you have a central bank that you people here in Utah use to clear checks, use credit cards, and other unjust weights and balances that are prohibited in the scripture? Again, nearly everybody in the audience raised their hands and said, oh yeah, we've got this central bank called the Federal Reserve here. I said, did you know that every country in the world has a central bank? Did you know there's a central bank in England, France, Germany, Russia, China? Did you know that? Cuba? And everybody is sitting now, you know, wide awake, wide-eyed, paying attention. And it was right here with the centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly, that the Ford dealer stood up with his wife and motioned to his children, and they walked out of the meeting hall. You see, boys and girls, in the first five planks to the Communist Manifesto, if I were to ask you, are you a practicing communist? We're not quite through with the 10 planks, but the first five, nearly everybody in America is practicing. Are they not? Aren't you? Now, I might point out that in 1900, just 100 years ago or so, none of these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto were in full force in effect. Oh, it's true. We had an income tax clear back to the Civil War days. In fact, I can trace you back a little bit further than that if we do a little historical research. In fact, the first income tax that was created here in the United States was created in 1778 in New York State. That's right. New York State enacted an income tax in 1778. By 1825, 25% of the states in the Union had an income tax. The income tax, boys and girls, goes back to ancient Babylon, Assyria, Greece, Rome, and Egypt. It is ancient. It's been around forever. If you thought that Karl Marx, sitting around, you know, in his stupor, funk up the income tax, the second and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto. Oh, no. No, it's been around for a long time. It's a religious practice. In fact, communism is a religion. It's a religion. Atheism is a religion. It's a belief in no God. That's all. Some people believe in Allah, and some people believe in Jesus, and some people believe in Buddha, and some people believe in no God at all. They're all religious ideologies. They're philosophies. Everybody's religious. Karl Marx was religious. Nikolai Lenin, Joe Stalin, George Bush. They're all religious. They have different religions and they worship different gods. They have different philosophies and ideologies, but they're all traceable back to a common origin way, way back into the distant past. Well, now that my host had now abandoned me and left the auditorium, left the meeting room with his family, because by the time we had finished the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto, I think that it had dawned on him that he was a practicing communist, and it was more than he could philosophically take. Because, you see, we Americans, since the end of World War II, have been radical, vehement, anti-communists. We have always seen ourselves as the good guys in white hats, and the communists are the bad guys in black hats. And we're the defenders of freedom and democracy around the world. And the communists represent the exact opposite to that. They represent tyranny. They represent everything that we loathe and despise. Surely we Americans could not be practicing that which we loathe and despise. Well, let's go on. The sixth plank calls for the centralization of the means of communication and transport in the hands of the state. And I pointed out to my audience that in this country we call that the Federal Communications Commission. And that you can't transmit over the airwaves your beliefs, your ideas, your philosophies. You have to get a license from the federal government, and they regulate what you can say over the air. As you listen to me right now over the airwaves, there are limitations on my right to free speech. I cannot tell you, I cannot say to you certain things that are prohibited by federal or state government. And there are certain things I have to tell you, mandated by law. They say, well, you've got to tell these people this, and you cannot tell these people that. So I just wanted you to know that even though you've got a First Amendment right to free speech and a First Amendment right to freedom of religion, you can't necessarily practice 100% of. Now, there is free speech in communist China. And there's free speech in Russia. There's free speech in totalitarian regimes all around the world. And then there are limitations on free speech in every country, including the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, and the democracies of Western Europe. For instance, we have prohibitions against hate speech. Did you know in Canada, if you were to say in Canada, I don't believe in the Holocaust. I don't believe that 6 million Jews were killed in Hitler's gas chambers and ovens. Do you know that's a crime? That's a crime in Germany. You're called a Holocaust denier. Well, at least in those two countries, Canada and Germany. I can't speak for anybody else. But now that's not free speech. It may well be that it is a preposterous lie. But the people who have enacted that kind of legislation don't believe in free speech. And neither do communists, and neither does the Communist Manifesto tolerate free speech. Now, if you wanted to say, I believe in the Holocaust, and I believe Hitler is really a no-good, dirty down-and-outer, and he got his just rewards. Now, that's the kind of free speech that you can say in Canada and Germany. Oh, that's fine free speech, whether you believe it or not. You can say that. So I just wanted to point out to you that the sixth plank is alive and well in the United States of America. Now, the seventh plank calls for the extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state and the bringing into cultivation of wastelands and the improvement of the soil generally in accordance with a common plan. I looked over the audience and I said, how many of you out here practice the seventh plank? Nobody raised their hands. They all looked at one another like, huh? What does that mean? Okay, said, I'm not sure that you understood what the seventh plank is telling you, so let me translate that into modern English. The extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state are called corporations, limited liability companies, artificial entities. Do you have any of those here in Utah? Oh, yes, everybody started nodding their head and raised their hands. Yes, yes, we have corporations. Limited liability companies, we have artificial entities here. I said, okay. And then the bringing into cultivation of wastelands in Idaho is called the Desert Land Entry Act. Do you have any government programs here for regulation and control of the public lands? No. Oh, yes, yes, we have that here in Utah. So, okay, that's two. And then finally I said, do you have anything in your call code, that deals with the improvement of the soil generally in accordance with a common plan, such as soil conservation districts? Oh, yes, yes, we have that here in Utah. I said, okay, well, then I guess everybody here is in agreement that we all practice the seventh plank to the Communist Manifesto, at least here in Utah. And everybody agreed, and I said, well, let me assure you that they do the same thing in Georgia, Florida, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey as well. So you're in good company. Went on to the eighth plank, and I said, it calls for the equal liability of all to labor and the establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture. I said, translated, that means, do you have a social security number? Equal liability of all to labor and the establishment of industrial armies. Social security has enjoined Americans into a gigantic industrial army. We're all members of the same group. You cannot work without it. Everybody was in agreement. Yes, yes, we all have social security numbers. I said, I'm going to skip the ninth plank, and I want to go to the tenth plank, and I'll come back to the ninth because it takes a little more time to explain. So I skipped over to the tenth plank, and I said, it calls for free education for all children in public schools and the abolition of children's factory labor in its present form and combination of education with industrial production. I said, do you have public schools here in Utah? Everybody raised their hands. Yeah, yeah, we all have. Do you send your children to these public schools? Well, a few people didn't raise their hands because they do have some private schools and quite a few Mormons homeschool. Mormons have never been very happy with the public school system. And so to their credit, many, many Mormons have jerked their kids out of the public schools, and they educate them privately at home, or they send them to a parochial school. But most, you know, probably 75% of the people in the room raised their hand and said, yeah, we send our kids to public school. So how many of you were educated in public school? You know, at least for some years. Nearly everybody raised their hands. Of course, we've all been educated in public school. I'm a victim of the public school system. I tell people very plainly, I said, I have been recovering from my institutionalization in the public school system for the last 50 years. I was institutionalized, by the way, boys and girls, for the first, well, not the first 12, but from age 6 to age 18, I was institutionalized. So I went on and said, do you have an abolition of children's factory labor in this state? Yeah. All right. I said, now let's go back to the ninth plank. That one takes a little bit more explanation. I said, it calls for a combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries and the gradual abolition of the distinction between town and country by a more equitable distribution of population over the country. Now, what that is translated into, it calls for urban renewal, population control, metro regional planning programs. And I said, in 1922, here in America, about half the people in the country, 44% to be more specific, about half the people in the country lived on the land. They lived out in the countryside and they farmed or they did whatever they were doing out there. And about half the people in the country lived in urban areas such as the cities and so on. They were doctors and dentists and engineers and factory workers. And over the years, starting about 1920 or so, when our population hit about 100 million people, and you got about 50 million in the country and about 50 million out here in the city. And I said, a metamorphosis began. And what happened was Henry Ford started sucking all the people off the farms and into the cities with his $5 a day plan. And so people, by 1940, and the Great Depression, and the Dust Bowl had sucked those people off the land in the Midwest and put them in Los Angeles and San Francisco and Phoenix, Arizona. And they began to work in those cities. And so that by 1940, there were about 32 million people living on the land. Then World War II came onto the scene. And many people were taken off the land, put into the army, and sent overseas. And when those people came back from the army, instead of going back to the farm, they moved to the cities. They went to college under the GI Bill. So that by 1950, the population of people living on the land had decreased to about 15 million people. Then, between 1950 and 1969, there was a natural gravitation or attraction of people who would be born in the rural areas and on the farms. They would go to public school, they would then go to college, and then they would not go back to the farms because now that they've been to college, they had been trained to be doctors and dentists and engineers and so on, and so they would gravitate then to the cities and go to work for Boeing, Lockheed, and defense industries and so on. So that by 1969, the population on the land had decreased to about 6 million people. And then between 1969 and about 1985, which is about the time I was giving this talk, by the way, about 1985, or 86 or 7 along in there somewhere, the population now has decreased to about 3 million. It's halved again. And the projection is that by the year 2000, there will be about 1 million people living on the land, operating about 200 to 300,000 farming economic units, which will be huge corporate farms. I said, do you have anything like that going on here in Utah? And now everybody could resonate with that. Yes, the population of the Mormons in Utah has gravitated from the farms to the cities. And we're now city workers, and we're professionals now. Just like the people in New Jersey and New York and Chicago and Los Angeles. It's the same in Salt Lake City and Provo and Ogden. All right, so we got through, and here is an audience who have just been taken through the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and I ask the question, how many of you are practicing communists? And everybody in the room raised their hands. And now, if you too have your hand raised, you may lower your hand as I give you your mid-course reminder. And that is that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, now, do you remember when we began tonight's Odyssey, we said, I asked the question, are you a practicing communist? And I said, we Americans are suffering from an oxymoron. We deny that we're communists. We spent $1 trillion on national defense to protect America from a communist takeover, from a World War III, from a nuclear bomb war. America was pictured as the bulwark against communism for some 40 or 50 years, from about 1945 through about 1990. Boys and girls, Americans practice all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. Don't you think that's an oxymoron? Now, is communism dead? Has communism been defeated by the forces of democracy and freedom in the West? Well, if communism died in the USSR, then there ought to be established criteria, some fingerprints by which to identify this political corpse. What are they and where are they found? So let's turn to the Communist Manifesto, the 10 planks, their political agenda, to see whether communism has received a decent burial or simply adopted an alias called democracy to beguile the unsuspecting victims of a growing tyranny. Was communism gleefully announced by an anti-communist media that the USSR abolished its property tax, thus restoring absolute allodial tenure and title and ownership of land to the peasants? If not, then the first plank must still be alive and well, because the first plank calls for the abolition of property and land and the application of all rent of land to public purposes. And did your newspaper, USA Today, or Katie Couric, or Dan Rather, or anybody else announce the applauded eradication of income taxes in the USSR? No? Well, then the second plank must still be intact, because it calls for a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. Third, have your glossy magazines like Time Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report told you how the Soviets have repealed the inheritance tax in Russia? They didn't? Oh, son of a gun. Then those poor peasants still can't convey their hard-earned labors, their property, their inheritance, undiminished to their offspring. And remember, the third plank calls for the abolition of all right of inheritance. By the way, did you know that the Bible has an inheritance law? That inheritance is something that a righteous man leaves to his children's children? The fourth plank calls for, what about the Soviet directive stating that the IRS, I mean the KGB here, would no longer levy people's wages or ransack and pillage their homes? Well, you're kidding. You mean it wasn't in your Sunday paper or the Sunday supplement? Because the fourth plank calls for the confiscation of the property of all immigrants fleeing from the system and rebels, those who refuse to conform. The fifth plank. Well, surely, your trusty reporter on NBC, ABC, or CBS must have spoken about the Soviet plan to recall their funny money and to return the people's gold and silver and foreclose upon the banks. Ah, come on, not even on the late night news? Gee, this is getting serious, because the fifth plank calls for the centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. How about the sixth plank? Was anything said in the American press, up in our news media, TV, radio, about the restoration of one's right to use his own car on the people's roads without begging for a license? No? Well, how about the unregulated right to communicate freely? No again? Because it calls for the centralization of the means of communications and transportation in the hands of the state. About the seventh plank, has the news media in America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Western Europe, has your news agencies reported to you about the dissolution of the state-created corporations in the USSR, their factory farms, or that they no longer regulate the people's use of their own land? Oh, no? Remember, the seventh plank calls for the extension of factories and instruments of production owned and controlled by the state. Did they tell you about the Russian women being admonished by the state to rebuild the crumbling family unit and to reestablish the home as the principal haven and bulwark of child development? Hey, this is getting to sound like a broken record, because the eighth plank calls for equal liability of all to labor, to get mom out of the house so the big brother can steal their children and mold their minds to the state's use. How about number nine? Perhaps they explained how they've halted the corporate takeover of family farms. No? Well, are you sure you're not asleep at news time? Because it calls for the combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries. And then finally, the tenth plank. Well, certainly they did at least expose a reactionary Soviet plan to restore parental authority and the responsibility of families and parents to train up a child in the way he should go. And they did that by closing all of the state brain laundries. They're called schools, Virginia. Well, doggone it. Don't you ever catch on. Free education for all children in public schools. Now, boys and girls, if not one plank of the Communist Manifesto has been weakened, let alone destroyed or repealed in Russia, the old Soviet Union, then by what stretch of your imagination do they tell us that communism is dead, and why all this deception? Boys and girls, this is an oxymoron. Now, it's very simple. Americans have adopted communism, and we adopted it long ago. All 10 planks have been embraced by the Republicans and the Democrats, the liberals and the conservatives alike. For the media to divulge this now would expose their part in a conspiracy for not warning us. And while complacency, gazing into the electronic campfire that we call television, we were surreptitiously lobotomized, brain damaged, Virginia, and rightly did God say, "For as much as this people draw near me with their mouths and with their lips to honor me, but they have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid." That's cited from Isaiah 29, verses 13 and 14. "Now, having forsaken the Ten Commandments, and the statutes and the judgments and the commandments of our Creator, we have heaped to ourselves the curses of Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 through 68. Our ways have now become the ways of death. We kill our unborn infants, and we poison the minds of those others who survive birth to endure a godless education and a heathen media. Their bodies are wasted by no-win wars, chemical foods, and fluoridated water. Their heritage is given to strangers who cross the Rio Grande, while having to bear the burden of supporting anything and everything that is alien to our once Christian culture." All right, boys and girls, that is a citation that came from Kingdom Restitution Ministries by Bruce G. McCarthy in Smithville, Oklahoma, 74957. Wished I'd have thought that up and written that myself. But I like to give credit where credit is due. So again, that came from Kingdom Restoration Ministries, Bruce G. McCarthy in Smithville, Oklahoma, 74957. At another time, I had another experience, and I thought I'd share it with you. I happened to be over at Tupper Saucy's convention back in the 1980s. I kind of forget now exactly the name of the town. It was out in eastern Tennessee. Tupper Saucy, and he wrote the book called Miracle on Main Street. He was quite a prolific writer, and he put out a newsletter, and then one day the IRS came over there and closed him down and put him in jail. But before all that happened, he used to have an annual convention, and there'd be several hundred people, you know, attend. And so he invited me one year. He said, "George, would you come over here and speak?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'd be happy to do that." And so I was sitting at breakfast one day. It was in a big hotel, like the Holiday Inn or something. I forgot exactly what it was, but the meeting hall was pretty good size, and it was kind of out in the country, as I recall. It wasn't right in downtown, you know, something or other. It was kind of out in the countryside there. There was a couple of cows I noticed outside the hotel. While we were there, they had a restaurant, of course, in the hotel, and I was downstairs eating breakfast, and this guy came up to me, and he introduced himself. I was sitting there alone, just eating breakfast, and he said, "Mr. Gordon, may I sit down? May I have a word with you?" And I said, "Well, sit down. Go ahead." And he sat down on the other side. And I said, "If you'll pardon me, I'll just continue eating, because I'm going to have to speak here in a little bit." And so he said, "Well, yes, I'd be very, very honored if I could just sit here and talk to you for a moment." He said to me, he said, "Now, Mr. Gordon, do you practice this Mosaic law that you've been talking about?" And I said, "Yes, yeah, I actually practice that." And so I wrote this down, and this preacher who approached me in Suwanee, Tennessee some years ago, he asked me if it was true that I practiced the Mosaic Law, and I replied that it was true. And I was then asked if I practiced the sacrificial laws. He said, "Well, do you practice the sacrifices?" So I perceived that there was some craftiness in asking this forked question. You know, "Are you still beating your wife on Wednesday?" So I asked him if he practiced the Levitical priesthood here in Tennessee. And he emphatically denied that he did any such thing. And then he proceeded to preach me a fire and brimstone sermon about Jesus and him crucified and how Jesus did away with the sacrificial laws and the law of Moses. Now, I could see that this was a Christian, a man in great distress over doctrine. So I apologize to him for my outrageous suggestion that he might be a practitioner of the sacrificial system here in Tennessee. And I explained to him that I was a stranger from a far, far land called Idaho, and that I had heard that the people of Tennessee practiced this Levitical priesthood, and that they practiced sacrifices, and that they practiced heave offerings, but that they did so under another name, calling it instead the judicial system. He just stared at me as if I had announced that I was Mork from Ork. So I asked him if they had a state highway patrol system in Tennessee, and he admitted that they did. And then I asked if they had police, lawyers, judges, courts, courthouses, courtrooms with bars and benches and fines for criminal activities. And he once again admitted that yes, it's true. We do have highway patrolmen in Tennessee. And that we have police and lawyers, judges, courts, courthouses, and courtrooms with bars and benches and fines for criminal activities. And once again, he admitted that he and the rest of the people of Tennessee did have these things, and they made up the judicial system of the state of Tennessee. So I looked at him and I said that they had told me the truth then in far-off Idaho, that the people of Tennessee were a religious lot. And once more, he gave me that strange, far-off look and asked how the judicial system was religious. So I told him this story. I said, you drive down the road at 80 miles an hour, and the policeman, ever vigilant, looking for crimes, sees you and then roars off after you in hot pursuit. When he catches up with you, he asks you for your driver's license and notes that it does not give you permission to drive at 80 miles an hour. So he then arrests you and then takes you to the nearest jail, from where you are brought before the judge, who is sitting on the bench behind the bar in the courtroom, which is in the courthouse. You are then stood beside by your lawyer, who is before the bench and behind the bar, to enter a plea of guilty, which now makes you a criminal. So the judge then gives you a fine so that you can pay this fine, and in addition to that, he assesses you court costs. Now, if you do not like this procedure, you can appeal this to your state Supreme Court. And this is called the judicial system, and it's a part of the civil service. So I pointed out to my guest, as I finished my eggs, in olden times, this system was called the Levitical priesthood. And it worked in much the same way that your judicial system does today here in Tennessee. You see, the policeman of today is the equivalent of the high priest's servant in ancient times. It was the high priest's servant who was constantly looking for sin. Now, sin is an old English word, which, when translated into modern law, or in modern vernacular, sin is the transgression of the law. And we see that in 1 John 3, verse 4, in the scripture. So sin, then, is the violation of a law. Sin is crime. And when the high priest's servant, that is, the policeman, uncovers your sin, your crime, he arrests you, and he puts you in ward. We call those jails today. In the Bible, they're called placing you in ward, or in the dungeon, or in the prison. And this is usually located in the temple, which we today call the jail in the courthouse. Now, the courthouse is designed like a temple, because that's what it is. In ancient times, we had temples. We had temples all over Athens, and all over Greece, and all over Rome, and all over the Middle East. This courthouse is designed like a temple, and it sits in the town square where the high priest, you call him a judge today, wearing his long flowing robes, conducts the temple sacrifices in the holy place that you now call the courtroom. You, of course, will recognize the high priest in the holy place by his long, long black robes. Now, this high priest, who you call a judge, sits behind the altar, which you now call the bench, which is behind the veil to the holy place. Today, in the courtroom, we call it the bar. To pass through this veil, the bar, and approach the high priest sitting behind the altar requires an intercessor. This intercessor, called Mary in the Catholic Church, is called a lawyer in the courtroom, who will help you in your prayer, your plea, to the high priest, in your plea concerning your sin, which is your crime. Now, when you pray that you are guilty of this sin to the high priest sitting behind the altar, you become a sinner. And today, we call you a criminal. Now, the high priest then imposes a sacrifice of one ram of the first year, which is called the sin offering in the Bible. Today, we call this a fine, and we denominate it in dollars. This high priest, the judge, also imposes a heave offering. We call them court costs today. In ancient times, you paid a sin offering along with two turtle doves. Today, we call them court costs. Then, if you think you got a raw deal here at the local temple, you can go to Moses through the Aaronic priesthood to the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, and you can appeal directly to God Almighty Himself. Now, today, we call this an appeal to the Supreme Court. And this appellate system was set up by Jethro and Moses, clear out at Mount Sinai. This system of law in ancient times was called the Levitical priesthood. Today it's better known as the civil service or the judicial system. So I closed by chiding my Christian preacher friend a little by reminding him that he does indeed practice the sacrificial system of the state of Tennessee every time he goes to court and pays a traffic fine. Now, Tennessee is a sovereign, and a sovereign makes law, and a lawmaker is a god. And to violate this law of God is a sin, and a sin requires a sacrifice as a matter of law, whether it be the civil law of Tennessee or the common law of God directly connected with Moses at Mount Sinai. And the people who practice the religion of the United States make sacrifices to their gods, and they do it either voluntarily or involuntarily. So, in short, boys and girls, the policeman is the high priest's servant. Crime is sin. Going to jail is being put in ward. The courthouse is the temple. The courtroom is the holy place. The judge is the high priest. The bench is the altar. The bar is the veil. The lawyer is the intercessor. The plea is the prayer. Being guilty of crime is being guilty of sin. The criminal is a sinner. The fine is a sin offering. The court cost is a heave offering. The Supreme Court is the Holy of Holies, and the civil service, or the judicial system of your state, is a counterfeit of the Levitical priesthood. I say, boys and girls, that and that practice is an oxymoron. Now, essentially, our military and other resources are being used by the CFR, the globalists, as the spearhead of the New World Order. Not as a global Pax Americana, as there is nothing American about it, but as an extension of the Soviet model of communist expansionism. And this is to lay the foundations by force for a one-world government under a socialist United Nations administration that is core of the Bush doctrine, and it was his father's agenda, and it is the agenda of all globalists at the top levels, and Bush Sr. admitted it in the following statements. George W. Bush said, "We will give Gorbachev our assurance that America welcomes his reform, not as an adversary seeking advantage, but as a people offering support. I will assure him that there is no greater advocate of perestroika than the President of the United States." And George Bush also said, "It is the sacred principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter to which the American people will henceforth pledge their allegiance." President George Bush addressing the General Assembly of the United Nations February 1, 1992. And Bush's comrade Gorbachev admitted that communism would never go away if he could help it, and that perestroika was a mere cover for merging the United States and Russia under Leninist socialism. Mikhail Gorbachev said, "Gentlemen, comrades, do not be concerned about all you hear about glasnost and perestroika and democracy in the coming years. There are primarily for outward consumption. There will be no significant internal changes in the Soviet Union, other than for cosmetic purposes. Our purpose is to disarm the Americans and let them fall asleep." The essence of perestroika lies in the fact that it unites socialism with democracy and revives the Leninist concept of socialist construction, both in theory and in practice. Mikhail Gorbachev, Perestroika, New York, HarperCollins, 1987. "In October 1917, we parted with the old world, rejecting it once and for all. We are moving toward a new world, a world of communism, and we shall never turn off that road." Mikhail Gorbachev, at the Kremlin, in Moscow, November 2, 1987. Gorbachev said, "I am a communist, a convinced communist, and for some that may be a fantasy, but to me it is my main goal." Mikhail Gorbachev, New York Times, 1989. "And those who hope that we shall move away from the socialist path shall be greatly disappointed. Every part of our program of perestroika is fully based on the principle of more socialism and more democracy." Mikhail Gorbachev, Perestroika, New Thinking for Our Country and the World, 1988. Boys and girls, communism is not dead. Communism is alive and well and practiced by every American. And with that, I'm out of time. Let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.